You're listening to Heartland Politics with Robin Johnson, a production of WVIK, Quad Cities, NPR.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Heartland Politics show and podcast, which is aired on and distributed by WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. WVIK is the flagship public radio station in the Quad Cities region of northwestern Illinois and eastern Iowa. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and our focus today is on Mike Madigan, the powerful, legendary, and controversial former Speaker of the Illinois House of Representatives and Chair of the Illinois Democratic Party, and last symbol, I would say, of the powerful Chicago political machine that we've come to know. It seems odd and still hard to believe that in a matter of weeks, Madigan lost both of those titles, Speaker of the House and Chairman of the Illinois Democratic Party, and now even resigned his seat in the state legislature. So this is big news. I don't think it's totally sunk in yet with folks because he's been such a fixture on the scene. But this has implications for our state, not just the city of Chicago, but the entire state. And here with me to talk about that a little bit today is Bill Ruthard, who's a political reporter for the Chicago Tribune, has been on our show before. And I want to welcome you, Bill, and thank you for taking the time to talk today.
Good to be on.
This has been something you've been following, of course, closely, the Chicago politics and all, and did some reporting recently on the demise of the machine. But this seems like kind of the capstone to it. But let's talk about this a little bit. I mean, Mike Madigan elected back in 1970 and speaker for, almost forever for my adult life. But and now he's gone. What were some of the early signs that this was coming for those who don't follow politics closely and may still be in a state of shock that this guy's gone or happy or whatever? But what were some of the first signs that were coming that led many to believe he'd be in trouble in both positions?
Well, there are two major factors that kind of led to all of this. One was a sexual harassment kind of scandal within the ranks of both his political organization and his state house staff. They kind of start bubbling up, I believe, in 2018, and he had to account for that and parted ways with a few longtime senior aides and acknowledged that, you know, he needed to do better on that front. And I think, you know, that helped engender some opposition from women lawmakers within the Democratic caucus. And then the other major factor was this federal ComEd probe that has been ongoing. Madigan has been implicated in the investigation, though not charged. He's denied any wrongdoing. But the core of the matter is basically ComEd has acknowledged to an elaborate bribery scheme in which they made arrangements for essentially do-nothing political jobs in exchange for favorable response to legislation in Springfield. And so some folks close to Madigan have been charged in that, as well as folks with ComEd. And of course, that, you know, is a major blow, you know, just the association with that. So those two factors played in largely. And then on top of that, I also note that, you know, Bruce Rauner, the former Republican governor, was in office. He spent tens of millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, really, to make Madigan a household name in a way that he wasn't before. I think that the former speaker was quite happy in being kind of the behind-the-scenes operator, chair of the party, but not necessarily, you know, the face of it. And, you know, there was always a Mayor Daley or a Barack Obama or somebody else, Blagojevich, who maybe it would have been more recognizable in the homes of Chicagoans and Illinois residents. But that started to change with Rauner really driving up the negatives on Madigan, associating just about everything that was wrong in the state of Illinois with the former speaker. And so I think when you blend all those three factors together, and then on top of that, a real dramatic shift in Democratic politics in Chicago in particular, and in the suburbs, you see a lot of these seats in areas that were once held by Republicans starting going to Democrats, but the Democrats getting elected did so by, you know, promising not to support Madigan for speaker and being more moderate. A lot of women won those seats, which helped play into some of these newcomers who withdrew support for Madigan as speaker. And then in the city of Chicago, you know, the politics had become increasingly more progressive in a real rapid way. And that kind of coincides with the rise of Bernie Sanders and his two presidential campaigns. Just a decade ago, we had no Democratic Socialists on the city council in Chicago. Now we have six. We had one LGBTQ alderman. Now there are six. And the politics in the city have become increasingly progressive. And then, you know, that has led to turnover. 70% of the city council is new in the last decade. The same holds for Chicago area state house and senate seats. And so you had this turnover. And when Madigan looked around the room, he didn't have the old allies that he once did. And so that's a very long way of answering your question, but there's a lot of factors involved. And I guess that the last thing I'd point out is we really started getting a sense that Madigan was in trouble in the fall. Lawmakers in the Democratic caucus started coming out and basically saying that they weren't going to support him. And the number eventually reached this group of 19 House Democrats, all of whom had been elected in the last decade, pledging not to support him for Speaker. And that was ultimately enough for Madigan to have to step down. And Chris Welch was elected as his replacement.
You bring up a great point about the literally millions of dollars spent by former Governor Rauner defining Madigan in a negative way as the face of the Democratic Party. And a lot of folks in our region, of course, received multiple mailers with Mike Madigan's face, along with our Supreme Court Justice Tom Kilbride, who's from the Quad City area. And a lot of people feel right. Like that really hurt Kilbride, and it's a manifestation of the way that Madigan was used negatively downstate. I do remember the days when he wasn't that well-known. So mm-hmm. I think that's a great point that played into all this. You mentioned Chris Welch, who's the new Speaker of the House, African-American from the suburbs, I believe, of Chicago. We've had, you know, a turnover. We've got a new Senate president as well, who's from Chicago, Knox College grad, I'll say, from the region. And, of course, J.B. Pritzker was elected governor. It's Chicago heavy. What, Bill, do you think might be some of the implications of the turnover there? Is, I mean, Mike Madigan was a guy, you got to say, although he didn't last all those years by being a dummy. He stayed away from problems, and it finally maybe caught up to him a little bit. But what will this mean in terms of potential policy directions for the state that might impact downstaters here? And any thoughts on that?
I mean, I think you're going to continue to see the politics get more progressive. I think just like some of the old machine politicians on the Chicago City Council kind of kept things in check from over the years, you know, with their disappearance, we've seen, you know, a larger emergence of these issues, increased minimum wage, things of that nature. And I think we're going to see that at the state level. We've already seen it some with Pritzker and some of the policies he's favored, but look no further than the massive criminal justice reform legislation that passed in the most recent session after Madigan stepped aside. So I think you're going to continue to see more progressive policies. And I think, you know, for downstate, you know, I think it depends. There's obviously different regional issues and effects. And obviously the minimum wage play out is one of those, right, where the cost of a small business owner paying that hourly rate in Rock Island or in Carbondale is different than it is in the city of Chicago with the higher cost of living. So I think, you know, there's going to be some pent-up frustration and some efforts to get legislation passed. It's going to boil over here. Madigan kept a really tight grip on his caucus. Very few bills ever really moved in the legislature. And if they did, it was because he wanted them to. And I think we're going to see a more open and freewheeling process. Now, Chris Welch is an uber, you know, reformer. He's not viewed that way. He is viewed as part of kind of the Democratic establishment. But to get support to become Speaker, you know, he agreed to some reforms and how legislation moves through the State House. And I think what we're going to see is a more open, freewheeling process that might be messier. I think especially with the, you know, the legislative remap that's going to be coming up this year with the 2020 census. New State House and Senate districts will be drawn, as well as congressional and local seats. And I think, you know, Madigan controlled that process very closely behind closed doors. I'm not sure we'll see that this time. I think it could very well be a more open process. Doesn't mean it won't be very political, and doesn't mean gerrymandering is going to go away by any means. But I do think that things could be a bit messier than they have been, just because you don't have the same man controlling the state house and the party.
I begin to wonder, too, if in some ways Madigan seemed to keep the progressives at bay at times in the past, not allow them to perhaps go too far. He was more of a believer in incremental change. he was also kind of a moderating factor and did battle with both Bruce Rauner and Rod Blagojevich back to a couple of the more unpopular governors. I wonder, do you think, have any idea if I mean, will some folks begin to regret him leaving and some strange irony that his ability to kind of keep control of things, or is that momentum towards openness and transparency just, I mean, it was time for him to go?
It sure seems like it's the latter. I mean, we're talking about the longest serving state House speaker in American history. He held the job for decades and controlled the party since 1998. And I think, you know, for those that want a more moderate set of Democratic politics, I'm not sure Madigan offered that as much as maybe he did a decade or two ago. He clearly evolved as the party's politics did. And unlike Dan Lipinski, you know, who remained opposed to gay marriage and opposed to abortion for his entire career and lost to a progressive, you know, Madigan did evolve over the years in many ways. And one of his legacies is that, you know, the caucus in Springfield became more diverse. But, you know, that's also a product of demographic changes, both in Chicago and in the suburbs. And so, you know, he changed with the times. He was a astute political operator, and he changed with the times as required. And I think those continued changes are still in place in Illinois. And so, you know, whether folks will regret it, I mean, I just think that the negative association with Madigan at this point makes that difficult for most, whether it's the association with Chicago politics, whether it's the federal investigation, whether it's the sexual harassment issues within his staff, whether it's just the sheer longevity of how long he's been in place. And that doesn't even bring up some of the legacies, right? The massive unfunded pension liabilities in the state, the list goes on and on. So I think when somebody's writing a historical book and we have another decade or two and see how it turns out after Madigan, you know, maybe somebody would have that perspective, but I think it's difficult to make that assessment at this point.
Yeah, maybe a little too early to draw broad conclusions about his legacy. It just still seems pretty fresh. You know, in fairness, there's a lot of things, the population loss, the pension debt, the problems we've had, and the fact that he's been in office during this all this time. He's got to wear part of that. But I'm sure there'll be efforts by other people to kind of bring up some of the positive things. And you mentioned them. He did bring along more diversity and leadership in the House, and did pass along some measures that were good for the people as a whole. But I think that probably his legacy is yet to be written completely. Maybe we just need a little more time.
Yeah, I think that's probably part of it. And I think, you know, legacy, you know, all depends on what comes after. I mean, I think if you ask folks what they thought of George W. Bush right when he left office, they might have one view. But now that you've seen Donald Trump after that, I think people have a different view, right? So yeah. What happens next plays just as largely as what happened while he was there, I think, when you're evaluating legacy. And that goes for the federal investigation, too, right? This is an ongoing federal probe with the U.S. attorney who, at the request of Senators Durbin and Duckworth, will stay on until probably at least the fall as Joe Biden looks for a replacement. Unlike many U.S. attorneys around the country who, you know, stepped down right away, he's staying on and continuing his work on this probe and others in the Chicago area. So, you know, whether, you know, Madigan notoriously didn't have a cell phone for most of his career, didn't use email, I think it's a lot of folks view it as possibly difficult for the feds to indict him, but it's an ongoing issue, and it's obviously come very close to him so far. So we'll have to see how that plays out as well.
You're listening to Heartland Politics on WVIK Public Radio in the Quad Cities. This is your host, Robin Johnson, and my guest today is the Chicago Tribune's political reporter, Bill Ruthart, who's joined me today to talk a little bit about Mike Madigan, who's kind of quickly and surprisingly somewhat disappeared from the political scene, no longer speaker, no longer chair of the Democratic Party, no longer even in the Illinois House of Representatives. We've talked a little bit about his legacy and kind of what led to this surprising turn of events. And I want to kind of put this into a sense of what's going on in Chicago. Again, our listeners, look and have a certain view of Chicago politics, the old machine, and how it dominates state politics. some of that's changed, and I think it impacts all of us in the state, and it's why it's an important topic here today. But what's going on with the latest? You've been covering this closely, I know, Bill, with the Chicago machine. Is it still the vaunted political machine that we've all learned about in the past under Mayor Daley, or is it changing and opening up?
It's definitely changing. I think, you know, if the machine isn't dead, it's in hospice care, at least the machine that we've all known and for many years. I mean, Madigan was one of the last vestiges of the old patronage model. And, you know, there's just not many of those folks left. Ed Burke, who's a 50-year, more than 50 years, is a Chicago alderman, also indicted recently and awaiting trial on racketeering and bribery charges. And so a lot of the old-timers that were the power players are leaving the scene, and they're being replaced by younger candidates of color, many of them far more progressive, and a lot of them supported by progressive unions, the Chicago Teachers Union and the Service Employees International Union. And these are unions that are at the forefront of fighting for, you know, the increased minimum wage nationally and a host of issues locally. And the Chicago Teachers Union again showed its strength in recent weeks, going toe-to-toe with Mayor Lightfoot over whether to reopen the schools. And we saw them strike earlier in her tenure. And so I think, you know, the traditional machine is dead. The question is, what comes next? And do we actually see true reform, or do we see a more diffuse kind of little fiefdoms all around the city and still a level of corruption? I mean, there's plenty of former aldermen and former state reps and state senators currently facing federal charges to suggest that the corruption is alive and well. I think, you know, what we're looking to see is whether this kind of new progressive leadership, if they're interested in more than just kind of the social and economical issues, and whether they're interested in political reform. And what might that look like? It might look like, you know, a lot more transparency around lobbying and campaign finance. It might mean public funding of campaigns, which you've seen in New York, to take some of that pay-to-play out of the local politics. And so I think, you know, the traditional machine, the ward organization, the precinct captains taking care of everyone on the block, that's almost by and large entirely gone. There's a few wards where that still is partially in place, but I think another election cycle or two, it'll be gone forever.
And they've taken a beating, the machine has, in recent elections. Lightfoot was not a machine candidate, and then kind of the obscure office, I believe, of assessor was a major machine backed location for patronage and whatever else, and helping people, their close allies in Chicago. And they've been routed. What, those elections weren't even close, as I recall.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the last two chairs of the Cook County Democratic Party were Joe Berrios, who's county assessor, longtime practicer of nepotism and patronage, and a Chicago Tribune investigation that basically showed that the property tax assessment system in Cook County was rigged to benefit, if not rigged, and at least extremely broken, and to the benefit of the wealthy and at the expense of lower income homeowners and business owners. And, you know, with that out in daylight, we had a reformer in Fritz Kagi who ran against Berrios and defeated him. And then on the heels of that, in 2019, you had 14 candidates run for mayor when Rahm Emanuel stepped aside. And one of them was Tony Preckwinkel, the current Cook County Democratic Party chair and president of the Cook County Board. And she ended up in a runoff against Lightfoot and got swept in all 50 wards of the city, including her own down at Hyde Park on the south side. And then, we saw Lipinski, Dan Lipinski, who in the Chicago tradition, basically inherited his congressional seat from his father, Bill, who went on to lobby the very transportation committee his son would go on to serve on. The Lipinskis finally lost their congressional seat to progressive Marie Newman. And then, you know, there's these other traditional machine wards around the city, all of which have seen change in leadership. Many of them old white wards, now represented by young Latino or African American aldermen. And one last note, I mean, the Chicago City Council, there's 50 seats. For the first time ever, there are more black aldermen on the council than white, and the Latino number is growing substantially, and I think we'll see it continue to grow with the next set of ward boundaries here that will be approved later this year. So the machine ain't what it used to be, that is for sure.
Is there any, and I'm serious when I ask this because you'll probably get a chuckle, but is there any sign of life in the Republican Party in Chicago with, and I ask that because with the leftward movement, and we can talk about policy here again, as far as downstate people viewing what the agenda is from Chicago representatives. But I'm curious if there's any kind of pushback among more moderate elements, and maybe even in the Democratic Party, or any remaining conservatives to give any force to signs of life for the Republicans in Chicago.
Well, there's the voters and then there's the party structure, and I'll separate those for a reason. I mean, the Cook County Republican Party is you know, on its deathbed, I guess I could say. I mean, the few seats they had on the county board have been diminished. In the city of Chicago, you know, the aldermanic seats are nonpartisan, but there's no, you know, open Republican representing any of the 50 wards. However, you know, we do see Republican votes in the city. And you can look at the results in the presidential election. Donald Trump won some precincts on the southwest and northwest sides of the city, which are areas that are more white, more blue-collar, city workers, cops, firefighters. And, you know, in Bridgeport and around the home of the Daley family, you know, there was some support for Donald Trump in some of those areas. And so those southwest and northwest sides tend to be a bit more conservative. And then you have your high dollar downtown set, which also tends to vote Republican in, you know, national politics. And so you'll see a very varied viewpoint on the city council in Chicago, but nobody who's, you know, openly a Republican. And I think, you'll probably kind of see that trend continue. And the way, you know, Chicago's state congressional maps are gerrymandered, it's difficult to envision that changing anytime soon.
So I'll circle back to some of the policy implications for all this, because this is important for folks down in our area and across the downstate region. And we saw some manifestation of it in the police reform bill that was passed, which was pushed by the governor and a lot of progressive legislators, African-American legislators. With the progressive push in Chicago with the machine on life support, as you said, or hospice, what will be some of the policy implications? You mentioned the $15 minimum wage, which a lot of folks downstate look skeptically at because difference in costs and all. And also, the Fair Tax Amendment pushed by Governor Pritzker went down. A lot of places down here opposed it or didn't support it with near the amount needed.
Well, as a Rock Island native, I'm astute in the differences between the local politics in the Quad Cities and certainly in Chicago and in the suburbs here. And I think one of the issues that, you know, I think continues to need to be addressed is the disparity between Iowa and Illinois, both on taxes, but also some of these policies that you just mentioned. And so, I'm not sure, the governor's, you know, articulated a plan on how to deal with that. I do think that, it's not a one size fits all situation for a lot of these downstate areas. And we've seen the Democrats, you know, enjoy gains in the suburban stretches of the state, but then there are other areas that traditionally, you know, sympathetic to Democrats that are starting to turn the other way, right? And Sherry Bustos had a tough time holding on to her congressional seat in the last election, I think is a prime example of that. And we've seen other, even more local races pan out that way. And so I think, and also just the approach on COVID has been dramatically different between Iowa and Illinois. And so I just think the awareness of the differences between the states on the border is front of folks' minds in the Quad Cities, at least the ones I know who still live there. And yeah. So I do think it'll be interesting to see what the governor does about that and how he addresses it. The thing has to be true, down in the St. Louis region and elsewhere in the state. And I think, how much influence, those regions have in the capital remains to be seen. But we are not in the days of a Denny Jacobs who can walk into Madigan's office and find a project that's needed for the Quad Cities. So it'll be interesting to see how this all plays out, how much power Pritzker amasses now with Madigan gone. Does Welch serve as a check on him, or does Madigan, with his limitless wealth, consolidate his power and basically, become a new form of Madigan in the sense of, having control over the party and the capital. I'd say one issue that points to perhaps that won't be the case is the fact that, Pritzker was unsuccessful in getting, Chicago Alderman Michelle Harris to be elected as the next day party chair. It was Robin Kelly, the congresswoman from the South Suburbs, who won that post, and she was backed by Senator Durbin. So at least some cracks in the armor there for Pritzker initially, and it'll be interesting to see kind of how that plays out.
I forgot that you were a Rock Island native. I was remiss in not mentioning that at the top. A lot of folks out there will probably recognize the name, the family name. One last point, we'll be done. One thing I will miss, Bill, about the Chicago machine, the sayings like, we don't want nobody sent. You included that in your piece, and I will miss sayings like that, but it's probably a good thing for Chicago politics and the state.
Yeah, well, there's plenty of lore and legend, and none of that, of course, goes away, and there's great debate when you talk to folks. For that most recent story, I think we interviewed something like 36 elected officials and political operatives in Chicago, and some believe the machine is dying right now. Some believe it's been dead for a decade or two once patronage was basically outlawed. Some think it's alive and well. It's just going to take on a new form. It'll be, a different type of machine. So, but some of the characters of times past certainly are no longer on the scene, and I think that's where some of those classic sayings and stories, come from, and we'll have to see which next ones are written.
Yeah. All right. Well, Bill, thanks so much for being my guest today. Bill, Quad City, Rock Island native, Bill Ruthard, Chicago Tribune political reporter, has been our guest today, talking a little bit about the demise of the Chicago machine, the demise of Mike Madigan, and what it all means for us. Bill, thanks so much for being a guest today.
Great to be on. Thanks, Robin.
Heartland Politics is a production of WVIK, Quad Cities NPR. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can hear more on the Heartland Politics podcast, available at WVIK.org, in the WVIK app, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.